yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we want to talk about the presidential debates once more time, but to look at it from a different perspective. In other words, what do these debates portend beyond November 8th? What can we see here within the debates, behind the scenes, so to speak, of the words of what is actually happening, not in the debates, but in this election itself, and in a deeper sense, what's going on in the country. In other words, those more fundamental developments that are going to continue after November 8th, and what might it mean for U.S. politics and economic policy in 2017 and beyond. Step back, in other words, step back a little bit and look at it, the debates in a broader context, and what do we see, right? Well, you know, the third debate here that was held a few days ago on October 19th, it was perhaps the most critically important of the three debates. Not so much for what was said, or even how it was said, you know, the mudslinging and so forth, right? But for what it may indicate for U.S. policy, economic and political, in the post-election period. Now, what can we sort of discern from what's been going on with these debates and this election here in its final stages that's more fundamental and trend-setting, indicating of shifts and changes coming, right? Well, you know, if you watch the debate, it began with a reasonably rational discussion covering topics of Supreme Court appointments, Second Amendment gun rights, abortion, and immigration, right? Revealing the deep differences between the two candidates on this, but, you know, they weren't going after each other, you know, with tooth and claw yet. But then, as in the previous debates, it quickly exploded. Right? As the debate addressed the topic of immigration, Trump noted that Barack Obama was the biggest deporter of undocumented Latinos in U.S. history, a fact which Clinton has consistently avoided, he charged, which is true. Trump then referred to the recent WikiLeaks revelations, where Clinton declared she was in favor of open borders throughout the Western Hemisphere. Trump suggested her open borders remark was really an indication of her true position on free trade, but also indicated that she was soft on cross-border labor immigration. Okay. By the way, that open borders remark that was revealed by WikiLeaks, and what she had said at that time was she was in favor of open borders in terms of goods and investment flows throughout North and South America. Well, that was the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas deal proposal that Bush had raised back in 2005. That was a Bush proposal. So she was embracing a Bush proposal. You know, at the time, it did not pass the FTAA, Free Trade Agreement, of America's agreement, and the Bush team settled back on Central American Free Trade Agreement and some bilateral agreements, Colombia, Panama, and so forth, that Obama later endorsed and signed, even though he said he was against free trade when he ran. You can't believe what they say about trade. or taxes when they run. They do just the opposite, because trade and taxes are big money items for the rich and the corporations, you see. They tell us what they think we want to hear, and then they go and do anyway what their campaign contributors want them to do. Anyway, you know, this Open Borders WikiLeaks revelation about trade and labor flows was kind of like a signal to Clinton, like she was waiting for it, I think. And she quickly jumped on it and used it to attack the WikiLeaks issue itself, and to then transform the discussion of WikiLeaks to deflect addressing the challenge that Trump had made to her, right? These WikiLeaks revelations are kind of a multi-edged sword against Clinton. They reveal, you know, have revealed not only her position on open borders, and i.e. contradicting her claims that she opposes the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade treaty and free trade in general, of course. So the WikiLeaks kind of says, well, wait a minute, you say you're against free trade, but here's what you really said when people weren't watching, you see. So WikiLeaks kind of, you know, pokes her on the trade and labor flows issue, but it also has touched another political raw nerve for Clinton, and that's her email cover-ups, you see. All this stuff about email cover-ups is coming from WikiLeaks revelations as well. WikiLeaks also reveals Clinton's cynical dual communication strategy idea, right, where she consciously says one thing to bankers and big business and then another to the U.S. public, right? So the WikiLeaks revelations are kind of a strategic linchpin for the Trump campaign, right? Raises multiple issues on which Clinton is vulnerable. So whenever the WikiLeaks thing has been brought up, clearly her advisors are instructing her to go on the attack against WikiLeaks itself. Well, what is that attack? Well, it's to say, oh, WikiLeaks, the Russians are behind WikiLeaks. So, you know, are you for the Russians here? Are you supporting the Russians? Because the Russians are WikiLeaks, and I always make that identity. And then to go from there and say, well, WikiLeaks, Russians, oh, Putin, right? This all comes from Putin. Putin is engaging in espionage in our political system and is upsetting our election. Interfering with our election. How dare anybody interfere with American elections? We can interfere with theirs, but they can't interfere with ours. How dare they, right? And then it's one easy step to say, well, Putin, Russians, WikiLeaks interfering with our democracy, and from there to link it to what's going on in Syria. Oh, Putin, war criminal. Putin, you know, bombing Aleppo. Therefore, we should have a no-fly zone. She raised this no-fly zone in Syria issue in the second debate, and now quickly used the WikiLeaks issue when it was raised in the third debate to go on the offensive again on this question of Syria and a no-fly zone. Now, it's interesting. At one point in the presidential third debate here, the moderator, Chris Wallace, indicated to her, well, you know, your generals, four-star generals here, indicate that a no-fly zone in Syria will probably mean a war with the U.S. and Russia, because the Russians will not abide by a no-fly zone. And what do you do when they don't? Do you shoot their planes down? And what happens when they respond and shoot our planes down? Well, now you're in a war. This is very serious, you see, what's going on in Syria, and if you're talking about a no-fly zone in Syria. By the way, she also mentioned, when asked directly, she was not in favor of reintroducing American troops in Iraq as an occupying force. Well, you know, all you have to do is send the troops and say, well, we don't tend to keep them there. Someday we'll take them out. And then it's not an occupying force, you see. So she's indirectly leaving the door open for recommitting U.S. troops in Iraq, which may happen if this battle in Mosul, which is underway right now, does not turn out successfully. All right. So no-fly zone, challenge the Russians directly, play chicken, you know, in Syria, and reintroduce maybe troops in in Iraq. Wow, this is really serious. This is war zone talk. Excuse me. It's dangerous. This is Hillary the war hawk here, and we better be careful. Read between the lines what's actually happening in this election. Well, what's happening is the elites in the U.S., particularly the neocons, which are, you know, deeply embedded in the State Department, are growing frustrated with their policies in the Middle East, which aren't working. Clearly, the U.S. Staked in Syria, staked its whole case on uniting these anti-Assad different groups, which include Al-Qaeda and those kinds. And they can't bring them together. It's like herding cats, you say. They can't get them all together on the same, the U.S. can't, on the same plan here. And they're all splitting and fighting with each other and so forth. And that has meant a bad strategic choice by the U.S. on how to depose Assad and make a regime change. The U.S. strategy is not working. At the same time, the Russian strategy is, you see. The Russian strategy was to come in on the side of Assad and protect him and take on, you know, the rebel groups, the various rebel groups, including ISIS. And the Russian way of doing that is just bomb the hell out of them. You know, that's the way the Russians prevailed in Grozny. You know, when they had their fight against Grozny as the, you know, that province, when they were fighting the Chechens, right? They just leveled the cities there. That's the Russian way of doing it. And that's what Russia is doing, of course, in Syria, and it's being successful. You know, Assad is recovering. Well, the U.S. Is in a deep deep problem over there in Syria because the Russians are gaining influence and the U.S. is losing influence, you see. So the neocons in the State Department are pulling their hair out, and they're arguing we need to go in to Syria much more seriously. Or as Hillary said, quote, we need to up our game plan. Scary situation there. What that probably means is they'll put back pressure on Russia should Hillary be elected, probably in the Baltics or East Europe, as a way of trying to force Russia to the bargaining table. They'll threaten no-fly zones, and they'll hope that they can negotiate a compromise with Russia in Syria. But that's a risky venture. I don't think they'll be able to pull that off. And then what? The neocons dominating, directing U.S. foreign policy from time to time here, a very dangerous development in the U.S., but it's still going on. To his credit, if I can give him credit, Obama, as he's leaving out the door, walking out the door here, refuses on his watch in the last hour to go into Syria and escalate that conflict. But that the next president certainly will have that choice. Very dangerous. That's the most important, one of the most important things, I think, in the third debate, this reiteration of no-fly zones and more aggressive stance in Syria and the Middle East. If you read between the lines, that's coming, you see. The U.S. elite has, political and economic elite, has decided that okay, we need to up our game, as Hillary says, and do something there. And, you know, this whole WikiLeaks thing is being turned around by Hillary and used against Trump, right? WikiLeaks, Russians interfering U.S. elections, WikiLeaks, Russians, Putin, Syria, no-fly zone. Do you support Putin? Donald, I mean, she said it right to him, you know. She said this was the WikiLeaks release. It was, some, quote, the most important issue tonight, right? And then charged Trump with, quote, willing to spout the Putin line. And you continue to get help from him, Putin, and you are his favorite in this race. In other words, pretty much smearing Trump as a... the puppet, actually, they said that, the puppet of Putin, right? It was effective. But, you know, he came back, Trump came back, and he said, well, you just witnessed, you know, a classic pivot here, refusing to answer my question or my challenge, you know, based on these WikiLeaks, which is was so strategic to the Trump campaign. It's a wonder why he hasn't used it more. particularly with regard to the emails and so forth. At one point, they had an exchange on foundations, you see, their own personal foundations. But Trump did not press that personal foundation issue because it's the foundations that are behind or linked into these emails. You see, it's not an email issue. It's getting money. Emails is just a cover issue. It's getting money either paid directly, which isn't evidenced to Clinton for favors, but the payments go to her foundation, you see. And as soon as he raised that, she shot back to him, well, what about your foundation? And then the whole discussion stopped. Neither went further in terms of revealing how these foundations of the wealthy and the powerful in this country are really... economic slush funds for these people, you know, that they use in their political campaigns, who knows, you know? Who knows what the connections are here? But they all have these foundations. All wealthy people have these foundations. No one yet has really investigated what is the role of these foundations in corruption and in money laundering and in the rich helping each other out, their political making campaign contributions, and who knows what. I would like to see a thorough investigation of the whole foundation's connection, not just Hillary, not just whether Hillary's foundation has benefited from favors that she provided when Secretary of State, which is clearly there's a smoking gun here. But I would like to see how these foundations really aid and communicate and assist each other, these foundations of the rich, you see. They all have them. Actually, Clinton's have two. But no one's going there. And Trump wouldn't go there either because there's a lot of shenanigans in his foundation, I'm sure, as well. You know, that was quickly shut down. Of course, the commentator, the moderator, rather, Chris Walz, did not go there as well. But that's a whole area and a question that really needs to be explored here in this whole election and post-election period, the foundation's connections. That was one of the interesting exchanges. but back to the WikiLeaks. The WikiLeaks revelations are key for Trump, but Trump has not really pressed that issue aggressively as he might have. You know, it's the emails. Well, there's a lot else that's been revealed by WikiLeaks. But you know, what's happening is it's clear that the ruling elite in this country is now going after WikiLeaks. At the same time that this discussion was going on in the debate here, the Ecuadorian embassy in London, which has been shielding Julian Assange, which is the head of the WikiLeaks, right, cut off his email. Ecuador, the embassy, cut off his email. I'm sure that was done in response to pressure from the United States and by the political elites, you know, led by the the Hillary connection here, Democratic Party, who are saying enough is enough. You know, this guy's revealing too much. It's becoming a real embarrassment. So, okay, Ecuador, you won't release him so we can arrest him. What we're going to do is, you know, you at least have to cut him off. So now he's Assange is totally isolated and cut off. Whether WikiLeaks others associated with it will continue the revelations remains to be seen. But he has been silenced, and he will probably spend the rest of his life, if he gets to stay there, in that one room, one bathroom apartment in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. You know, how dare you embarrass us? We'll fix you. And, of course, that's what they're doing, right? But this association of Russia and Putin and WikiLeaks is being driven home as a message to the U.S. public. And then, of course, Putin is the next demonization target, you know, the next Saddam Hussein, Noriega, et cetera. You know, before you go after somebody, you have to create this demon impression within the U.S. public so you can go after him. that's really underway, connecting WikiLeaks with Putin, and, of course, then Putin in Syria and war crimes, et cetera, Aleppo, et cetera, right, all being associated here. This will continue after the election. You know, this policy of more aggressiveness in Syria by the U.S. will continue after the election. That's what we see going on behind the scenes here, revealed by some of the exchanges and the debates, right? Going after WikiLeaks, and not just WikiLeaks, but all challenges in terms of revealing free speech and et cetera, all challenges, all embarrassing challenges will be contained as well. An effort will be to, okay, we got to stop the WikiLeaks, we got to stop the Snowdens, and so forth. You're going to see a more restriction, in other words, on civil liberties, particularly free speech, right? That's coming after the election. What's also coming after the election is clearly these two wings of the one party of America. I call it the corporate party of America, Republican wing, Democratic wing. These two wings have been shaken here in this election year by challenges. We saw on, quote, the left, Bernie Sanders' challenge within the Democratic Party, right? Probably would have pulled off the nomination if he wasn't manipulated by the Debbie Wasserman Schultzes and others who really went after Bernie, as the WikiLeaks reveals here, and who knows what states like Iowa and others that that Bernie should have won that didn't win. All right, so but it scared the hell out of them that someone could come out of left field here and almost win the nomination from them. And the only thing that saved them was this this smart preparatory move they made with you know, strategic delegates. One third of them were party hacks. Saved the Democratic Party from Bernie Sanders, you see. But they will never allow someone to challenge again that way in the primary system. You will see the Democratic Party shoring up its defenses from any internal challenges to the corporate elite that run that party now. You'll see that happen. And you'll also see, even more obviously after the election, the Republican Party doing something of the same. They will not allow a Trump to prevail through the primary process the way he has this time around. There will be changes in their structures and their procedures and their regulations and rules within both of these parties to shield these parties from similar challenges in 2020. Right? That's coming. That's coming after the election. That's a legacy of this election as well, just as a legacy will be going after civil liberties further because of, you know, the embarrassments of WikiLeaks and a more aggressive foreign policy, particularly in the Middle East, and probably over in Asia too, because, you know, it hasn't been reported very much, but behind the scenes, Philippines just flipped to China's side here. Philippines has a new prime minister there, Duterte, and he's pretty much told the U.S. go to hell. And, you know, he's in China now, and he's announcing all these cooperative agreements with China and so forth. So this is a big strategic issue for the United States to lose the Philippines to China. Oh, you're going to see some aggressive action over there, that's for sure. The U.S. is probably going to try to depose him somehow. You know, there's real internal conflict that will be coming in the Philippines itself. And if the U.S. can't check this shift of Philippines to China, it's going to be a red flag that these other countries in Southeast Asia are going to really notice. You know, what should they do? Well, the U.S. can't even keep the Philippines, the former province, in its pocket. You know, maybe we should think about talking to China as well. So the U.S. Post-election has a big challenge out in the Pacific. It's not just the Chinese building islands out in the ocean to extend their control of and drive the U.S. Aircraft carriers back further from China's shore, right? And for China to be able to lay claim and develop the oil fields offshore there. That's what that's all about, right? But we'll see what happens. My guess is the U.S. will probably try to use Japan and South Korea as surrogates. And we're going to see the rearming of Japan. Japan has wanted to do this for some time, and they see that as a way, Abe, their prime minister, sees it as a way to try to boost its economy fiscally. And the U.S. may give Japan the green light to do that, because Japan's foreign policy and military has always been an appendage of the U.S. since 1945. The U.S. has had veto power of whatever they do in that regard. But I think the next president will think seriously about how to turn Japan loose and what can they do about losing the Philippines here before it's totally lost. See some aggressive action over there, just as you'll see aggressive action. You know, the wounded bear is the most dangerous bear. You know, it's going to come back charging at you. And the U.S. is now, in foreign policy terms, a wounded bear. So watch out. Watch out for that. Back to the third debate here, right? And this this question of WikiLeaks, and no-fly zones. That was the single most important development, I think, in exchange in the debate, right? And even Clinton herself said, quote, "This is the most important issue tonight." It shows you how important it is. And when she started talking about Russia and WikiLeaks and espionage interfering with the Democratic Party election by revealing, as if Russia has control of the WikiLeaks database, you know, and it's the one that's turning things loose. It's not. You know, WikiLeaks is not in the Russia's pocket, right? Of course, what it releases benefits Russia's propaganda campaigns against the United States, right? But what we also saw simultaneously this past week is that the British bank, a subsidiary of Royal Bank of Scotland, RBS, which is under government control in the UK, is one of those banks that was really taken over by the government, has informed Russia TV in the UK that it will no longer carry its accounts. This is a shot across the bow that the West, particularly U.S. and U.K., is going to shut down the Russia perspective and its, you know, its view of what's going on as these developments, Russia-U.S. developments, deteriorate further. Right? It's a warning to RT TV in the UK, and I predict you can expect the same soon to happen with RT America. And what's going on is the U.S. is also making it difficult for any of these media outlets offshore who have an alternative view to the U.S. Story, make it difficult for them to get their views out. There is a coordinated attack, for example, on Telesur, which is the South American media outlet, you know, the progressive, which, you know, they're being picked off down there, of course. Argentina and Brazil being picked off, but, you know, Venezuela, Ecuador, and Bolivia are still functioning as a critical of U.S. foreign policy. Well, their TV media network is called Telesur. Well, the banks, the U.S. banks, are being directed to go after and not handle the transactions of Telesur and others internationally. You see, the banks are working with the government to put pressure on these alternative media networks. And it's a harbinger of things to come, you know. As the crisis deepens here, as we go into a recession next year, as I've been predicting second half of next year, you know, the crisis will deepen, and what we will see is a further restriction of civil liberties and free speech and so forth, right? Well, this is the beginning of it. This is the, you know, the leading edge. Go after these alternative foreign media outlets that are communicating a different story to the American public. So, you know, this is something that's developing behind the scenes as well. So we have this new offensive, you know, civil liberties offensive that I see brewing behind the scenes. We have, you know, new military adventures brewing behind the scenes, both in the Middle East and in Asia, Southeast Asia, and the Pacific, that we can expect to continue to deepen after the election. Also, what's going to deepen very clearly is this internecine warfare within the political elite. You know, you can see it really brewing in the Republican Party. You know, there's a popular rebellion against the political class that is underway in this country, and that means a rebellion against both wings of the corporate party of America, right? And you see this in the Trump campaign very clearly. We saw this for a while with the Bernie Sanders thing, but Sanders threw in the towel and fell in line with the Democrats once again. But that doesn't mean the movement that he attempted to co-opt for his election and did is going to go away. That's going to continue. You see, the Bernieites or Sanderites or whatever you want to call them are going to continue to clash with the Democratic Party. There's no love lost between them. And I predict that should Trump lose the election, which is more likely than not, he will form a third political movement and a third party. That's coming. And if that occurs on the right, it will provide a stimulus for a similar movement on the left. Whether it will occur on the left or not remains to be seen. But it will be kind of hard for the Sanderites not to make an effort in that direction if the you know, the Trump followers do so themselves on the right. What we see, this rebellion against the political class taking the form of rejection of their political parties, right? It's a rebellion, but it's a rebellion that's not yet independent politically. It's occurring within the structures, the party structures of the ruling elite in this country. It hasn't broken off and become independent politically yet. It's an expression of rebellion within the institutional structures still. At some point, they're going to have to realize that you cannot reform these parties, which are Republican or Democratic Party, which are under the deep control of the corporate elites in in these in the U.S. Right, you're not going to reform them internally, and people will have to realize they have to do an outside strategy. They have to break and establish something independent of these two parties. You know, that's the next phase. And as this conflict, the rebellion within these two, the two established parties continues to deepen, we get all this internecine conflicts within the political elites within these parties. You could see it most intensely, of course, on the Republican side. What's fueling this all is a lack of real economic recovery in the U.S. and growing popular discontent. After 8 years, no real recovery for mainstream. Oh, they talk about GDP and they talk about consumption and so on and so forth. But, you know, those are all aggregate economic indicators which average out and smooth out all the different sectors of the U.S. economy. And what you got is the top 10%, especially the 1%, are doing extremely well recovering. In terms of recovery, but as you go down the income scale, people are doing less and less well, and that's the problem. You see, the middle class is being hollowed out. A lot of them, who once had decent-paying jobs to raise a family, can't do it anymore because they no longer have decent jobs. They've been replaced with service, low-paying service jobs, or no jobs at all. They're all out there hustling with two and three jobs, going nowhere, with health care problems and costs rising, with education rising. Now rents have been going through the roof everywhere. So their real wages and real incomes are being squeezed. And the prospects for improvement are not there. You know, the same with retirees. We have 50 million retirees in this country, and they're, you know, living off of Social Security, which is only $1,200 a month on average. Not enough. Their pensions, real pensions, have been destroyed and replaced with 401k plans, which just aren't moving. There's, you know, their savings, their personal savings, have not been growing at all. You know, the this policy of near zero interest rates is great for bankers and investors, but it's terrible for people on fixed incomes. A report was just released here not too long ago, a couple of days ago, I think, that said interest payments on fixed savings accounts. This is just savings accounts. I'm not talking about bonds or anything like that, right? According to the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, banks paid $29 billion in interest on $8.5 trillion of savings account. This is a return for grandma and grandpa retirees of 0.3%. 0.3%, not even 1%. You know, and the inflation is 2%. They're all going backwards, right? 0.3%. Well, this is the policy of the, you know, the central bank is near zero interest rates, which are great for bankers and investors. You know, it's allowed them to raise and give themselves $5 trillion. In the last year, stock buybacks and dividend payments, right? $5 trillion. But grandma and grandpa, 50 million grandma and grandpas out there with fixed income savings accounts earn 0.3%. Mm-hmm. That's a transfer from the retirees to the bankers and investors going on. That's only one of many examples of how the real income in this country is just not growing for most people and actually going backwards for many people, right? This popular discontent is what is fueling this rebellion against the political classes in their two parties. And as the rebellion occurs within their parties, it results in a lot of internal infighting among the political elites and the class. We see it, as I said, most obviously in the case of the Republican Party. That conflict is going to continue after the election. I predict the Republican Party is going to make a big move here to take on Trump and drive him out of the Republican Party. They're going to waste no time. And a whole new bunch of new rules to ensure that they never have a Trump again. Just as the Democratic Party is going to shore up its structure and rules to prevent any similar challenge from a new Bernie in 2020. What all this means is less democracy within the political party establishment, right? Just as it will have more of an attack on civil liberties, civil rights, and free speech, as they prepare for, the political elites prepare for new fights in the Middle East and Asia, we're going to have a restriction, further restriction of democracy. You're going to see this most obviously within the parties themselves. They're going to become really less democratic internally, and you know, that will drive the rebellion outside that structure. And that rebellion will have to decide what kind of structure, what form it will take afterwards, right? There are other problems other than, you know, the failure of economic recovery for all that is fueling a lot of this popular discontent. You know, 15 years later, you know, we still have the terrorist threat, right? We still have social crises. You know, education quality is dropping while the cost is rising. Retiring is becoming more and more difficult. More and more elderly people are continuing to work until they drop because they can't afford to survive any other way, right? We have safety issues, you know, police running amok. Black Lives Matter is a response to that. We have immigration issues still not resolved. We have millennials, the largest group in the country now, with little in the way of long-term prospects and hope. You know, they're the ones who are taking the brunt of the economic problems in many ways and the debt problems. They're the ones who are having to deal with the fact there's very few really good jobs that you can have a family on and really grow and have a future on, right? We have big changes in the job markets in the U.S. You know, most of the jobs are part-time, service, temp, contract, gig jobs. That's the future. And, you know, many of them coming out of, even with a college education and loaded up with debt, and the prospect of working, you know, gig jobs and part-time jobs, service jobs. Now, U.S. industry has turned towards this whole service, part-time temp kind of jobs. Not much to look forward to, right? And then we have these perpetual wars going on in the Middle East now for 15 years with no sign of victory anywhere. Totally inconclusive, right? This is what's fueling the political rebellion. People are getting tired of it, you see. And they're beginning to challenge it, you know, still within the institutions, party institutions in particular. But soon after the election, I think it will spill out from the parties, from within the parties to outside the party, kind of a response here. Because the conditions are not going away. And if we have a recession in 2017-18, that will exacerbate it all the more. And, you know, the media itself, it's true. The media, you know, lean one way or another against this or that candidate that they prefer. You can see, you know, the alternative parties, the Greens and the Libertarians, pretty much shut out of the election. You can see the attack on the WikiLeaks thing, right? You can see the emergence of political polls was really just marketing devices, attempts to manipulate public opinion. I mean, a lot of this critique of the media has some truth to it, right? Both on the right and the left. We may even see party splits, you know, not just the challengers breaking off and going their own way, but there could be even splits within the party itself. It's not going to happen immediately after the election, don't get me wrong, but you'll see the signs of the evolution that will occur before the next elections in 2020, I think, right? In this election process, too, you also see the rise of class issues once again. You know, the elites like to keep this thing away from the class issue. They like to keep everything, you know, within the context of identity politics, right? And non-economic issues and, you know, focusing on minorities of one case or another because that deflects from the class issue. But the class issue, the economic class issue, is beginning to assert itself once again in American politics. You see the white working class, uneducated, high school educated white working class, truly being abused and ignored by elites of both sides. Here comes Trump. He's the only guy talking to them. I don't think he'd do much for them, but he's talking to them. You know, they're clearly going for Trump. I don't think Hillary has a chance of pulling that vote, that cohort, whatever you want to call it, in the swing states in a lot of areas in the country. She's going to lose them, right? You got the millennials, and the millennials, you know, clearly aren't going for anybody. None of the above, right? Clinton is trailing well behind Obama for the millennials. Trump, too. He's not pulling millennial votes, right? Polls show 54% of the under 35-year-old group is currently not interested in politics at all in this election. And that's not going to change. You know, half of the under 35 group is turned off. Probably won't vote. Third-party candidates like Jill Stein, the Green Party, Gary Johnson, Libertarians, are polling 22% of the likely voters age 18 to 29. 22% for these alternative parties among the millennials. You know, you add on top of that this Harvard University survey this past summer that showed a third of Americans age 18 to 29 support some kind of socialism. A third of millennials favor socialism. Now, you know, what does that mean? That's going to be defined. But they're no longer scared off by the word socialism. And in that same survey, not even half backed capitalism. They're more opposed to capitalism than they are even pro-socialism, and they're increasingly pro-socialism, right? None of the above. The economy is the main issue, right? And that's going to get worse, not better, after November. Okay. Significant developments going on within the millennials here. Watch it. You know, whoever comes up with the proper formula to appeal to that group is going to have a you know, at least a partial advantage in the next election run, you know, 2020, even, you know, 2018. Who can come up with the proper program to address their needs and interests? Certainly not the two political parties that we have now. They're not doing a very good job of that. Hillary is promising a free college education, which is a Bernie idea, public institutions. But, our education institutions need to be totally revamped because they're not really producing the skills people need to survive. And that's a big problem. So, yes, they need to totally restructure public education post K-12. And even K-12 in a lot of places is just a disaster. You know, the solution is not charter schools. The solution is not just throwing more money. There needs to be a fundamental change and restructuring of the education system in this country. And, of course, that's going to cost money, but who's going to pay for it? Well, I propose that what should pay for it is a business-to-business value-added tax of 2% and use that totally earmarked to revitalize education that business really benefits from. Right? More skills and so forth. We got to stop all this H-1B and L-1 immigration, legal immigration into the U.S. You know, we're giving 300,000 plus jobs, high-skilled jobs in the tech sector particularly, you know, to people immigrating into the U.S. The corporations are bringing them in. You know, Trump talks about poor Latin Americans crossing the border. Well, no one's talking about the fact that the corporations are bringing hundreds of thousands of people every year to take the high-paying jobs. No discussion there at all. Well, because why? Well, you know, step on their corporate campaign contributors, particularly Democrats, who get a lot of money from the tech sector, Silicon Valley and the tech sector. So that's a big area, campaign donors, you know, from them and from the entertainment elites and from Israel, supporters of Israel, you know, AIPAC, which is the U.S. Israeli lobby company, right? I don't know how true it is, but there was a book not too long ago, a couple of years ago, that said that the Democratic Party gets 40% of its operating funds from AIPAC. Israel, in other words, rich supporters of Israel in the U.S., not from Israel, the country itself. We give them billions every year. So, you know, we've got this problem of real education restructuring that's necessary somehow. If someone's going to have to pay for it, who's going to pay for it? You know, I would say those who benefit most from it, the businesses. You know, we've got to do more STEM kind of education, you know, science, technology, medicine, and so forth. There's a big need for these people in the U.S., and they should be Americans. They should be people here that get this training for those jobs and cut off, you know, all that flow of hundreds of thousands every year coming in of foreign software engineers and so forth, right? That's the problem. You know, it's not the problem of Latin Americans coming across the border and taking jobs mostly that people don't want. You know, construction jobs and you know, working in kitchens and restaurants and stuff like that and cleaning up hotel rooms. That's where most of these people are actually working, you know, and actually doing something that fulfilling jobs that are needed in agriculture, of course, as well. Not too many U.S. college graduates want to go work picking watermelons in the Imperial Valley in Southern California, right? But they do want the high-tech jobs, right? But they're all be given away to H-1B and L-1 and L-2 visas coming into the country. And that's got to stop. All right. Lots of areas that need real renovation, restructuring, that you're not going to see it. The whole healthcare system. Watch next year. Big problem in healthcare. The health insurance companies are already putting the pressure on the government, boycotting, dropping out, saying we're not going to provide ACA, that's Obamacare insurance coverage, you know, that's a squeeze to get higher rates. They're already raising rates significantly. The pharmaceutical companies are price gouging the hell out of everybody, and all Congress is doing is having hearings, not doing anything. And, of course, that's driving up your health insurance costs in general and your premiums going through the roof. It's going to bankrupt Medicare if it continues, Part D Medicare. Pharmaceutical companies are gouging everybody, getting away with it. No one's really doing anything about it. People aren't going to be able to afford even ACA. And what is that? That's high deductible, thousands of dollars deductible, bare bones catastrophe insurance. Now, that's all they can afford under ACA. And some of them can't even pay that, and now that chicken's going to come home to roost as they're going to start being fined next year for not buying health care insurance, you see. ACA is really not a health insurance act. It's a health insurance company subsidy act. Big problems there that are going to explode. You know, and Obama set that up for a crash when he refused to support the public option, gave it up without even a fight, just to get him through his presidency, you see. and now whoever's elected has to pick up the rest of that that disaster. Yes, we'll see big issues with health insurance, ACA, pharmaceuticals, and so forth coming out of this election in 2017. Will they address these things? If they don't, you know, the rebellion will deepen. The popular rebellion will deepen, and people will find a way to resist. And if they can't successfully resist within the two political parties, they will find a way to resist outside those parties. Right? That's what's coming. You know, in the election debate here, the third debate, you know, they talked a little bit about this in ACA and escalating costs. They also talked a little bit about Social Security. Totally factually incorrect. You know, they say, oh, Social Security is part of our big debt problem. No, not at all. Social Security Trust Fund has a surplus. The retirement fund has had a surplus for a long time. The government's borrowing that surplus every year. You could easily solve that problem by raising the cap. You know, the cap meaning as people at the high end have gotten salary and wage increases, they've gotten a reduction in what that was intended they pay into Social Security. You know, it's got a ceiling of $118,000 a year. If you just raise the cap, you've got no problem whatsoever with the Social Security Retirement Fund for decades, decades. At the same time, you know, the runaway health costs are putting pressure on the Part B of Medicare. Okay, we'll be talking about this again next week, and I hope to have Jill Stein on. I've been trying to get Jill and Gary Johnson on the show, but we're going to make another shot before the election to do that. So tune in next week on Alternative Visions.